Welcome to Liberty Law Talk, part of Liberty Fund's online library of law and liberty. Your host is Liberty Fund fellow Richard Reinsch. Our website is libertylawtalk.org, where you can subscribe, comment, find other episodes and links relevant to today's conversation. Our email address is mail@libertylawtalk.org. We'd love to hear from you. Today we are discussing with Professor Eric Mack, Friedrich Hayek's Law, Legislation, and Liberty. Eric Mack is professor of philosophy at Tulane University, where he is also a member of the Murphy Institute of Political Economy. Professor Mack frequently publishes on natural rights and property rights, and he has published essays on law, legislation, and liberty. Professor Mack, glad to have you.
Thank you very much.
Friedrich Hayek is this great economist of the Austrian School of Economics who turns in the later part of his career to political philosophy, constitutionalism, and law, bringing to bear, I think, his considerable learning, his political economic concepts to these fields. And the three volumes of Law, Legislation, and Liberty, which we are going to discuss, are a tremendous aspect of this part of his career and this later focus. So let me ask you, sketch for us at the outset, what is Hayek trying to achieve in Law, Legislation, and Liberty?
Yeah. Well, I think you have to look at this work as a successor to the Constitution of Liberty, which Hayek wrote, thinking that that would be his great magnum opus. And Hayek had the good luck to live long enough that he decided he had to write another magnum opus. And I think that's what Law, Liberty, and Legislation is. So Constitution of Liberty has at its core the idea that of offering a new or restated defense of freedom. In that way, the Constitution of Liberty is a successor to Mill's On Liberty. But the defense of freedom that Hayek offers is really essentially a utilitarian defense of freedom. I think he's uncomfortable with that. And I think he decides that much more central to the case he wants to make is a focus on rules, and in particular what he calls rules of just conduct. And I think what happens in Law, Liberty, and Legislation is this refocus from freedom to the laws, to the rules of just conduct. It turns out that when the rules of just conduct are in place or articulated and enforced, as a side effect of that, people are free. But the focus is on these rules, and what makes the Law, Legislation, and Liberty such an important work is that in it, Hayek is able to emphasize the absolute centrality of rule and rule compliance to desirable social order. And he doesn't have that focus in the Constitution of Liberty.
So we should also say Law, Legislation, and Liberty is three volumes. The first volume, Rules and Order, second volume, The Mirage of Social Justice, and the third, The Political Order of a Free People. Most of our conversation will be on the first two volumes. So listening to you talk about Hayek and moving into Law, Legislation, and Liberty, the rules of just conduct. Now, can we talk about that? What are these rules of just conduct in precise detail?
Okay. Well, I think the crucial thing, and the thing that first got me to understand what Hayek is about, was an essay that Hayek writes about Hume's legal philosophy.
David Hume. Okay.
And so I think that's the easiest way to get into understanding Hayek. For Hume, there are certain sorts of rules which, if instituted, get human beings to a better place. And those rules are... without worrying about his particular terminology, the first rule is don't mess with other people with what other people have acquired peacefully from nature, and the second rule is don't mess with what people have acquired through voluntary contract, and the third rule is keep your agreements. His thought is that the institution of each of these rules tends to make everybody better off. Tends to make everybody better off as long as everybody can expect that these rules will be very strongly abided by everybody. So the crucial thing about these rules is that they vastly facilitate cooperation among individuals. And the crucial thing that we need, human beings need, is this cooperation. So the mark of a rule of just conduct or some particular manifestation of a rule of just conduct is that it's a norm which greatly facilitates human cooperation. And that's what we want. That's the focus of law, liberty, and legislation. How is human cooperation possible?
And of course, in the first volume, there is tremendous discussion about, shall we say, the displacement of this notion of law with the idea of constructive rationalism. So we might say Western man gets arrogant, as it were, and needs to consciously articulate a social and political order designed to achieve various ideological ends. And you know, we can just tick off the various ideologies that have been employed. So talk about this constructive rationalism, how Hayek defines it, and why it's so problematic. And we've kind of talked about what it's displacing, but I think it's crucial that Hayek seems to be rejecting heritage of the Continental Enlightenment in favor of humility and the givenness of social and political orders.
Yeah, I think, first of all, on the humility, obviously throughout Hayek, there's this emphasis on ignorance. That's a very big part of the argument for freedom in the Constitution of Liberty, and it continues throughout all his work. So the focus on our, in some sense, knowing much less than we than we're naturally disposed to think we know. So that's crucial. I think the contrast that Hayek works on throughout his works, it's never quite as neatly laid out as you'd like, is a twofold contrast. One is between different conceptions of social order, and one of those conceptions would be a designed conception of social order, one a spontaneous or undesigned conception. And then there are going to be two different conceptions of law which correspond to these two different conceptions of order. Maybe the good place to start is just his original more economic work, which is at least the part of it that is a critique of central planning. So he has, he along with Mises, has this critique which basically says that that central planners can't possibly have the knowledge that they would need to centrally plan. So that, if that critique is correct, there's a real problem with central planning, but it doesn't yet show how unplanned societies are possible. What's really crucial to understand how unplanned societies are possible is to understand how people are able to coordinate their behavior, again, with one another without there being any designer or arbiter of there. So the standard picture is just a picture of a nice little market economy where people start producing things because they in particular know there's a demand, and they in particular know that that they have the knowledge to produce the sorts of things they perceive as being demanded. And what arises is a lovely, harmonious order, but not on the basis of anybody's design. Maybe the non-human example that's best for this is an ecological order, which is an order that arises. An ecological order that arises without being commanded, right? At least it's not commanded if you don't accept a design argument for the existence of God. So Hayek's main mission in some ways in life is to explain to people how non-designed orders are possible, and they're possible on the basis of the particular elements within an order adjusting their behavior to local circumstances in ways that gradually produces a larger scale, harmonious ordering. If you have these two different conceptions of social order, you also are going to have two competing conceptions of law. In a designed order, the law is essentially a matter of command. Somebody has designed the order, somebody has designed the economic system, and it works by that person, with their supposed knowledge, issuing instructions to all the members of the system about exactly how they ought to behave. So law is essentially a command if you have this design conception of social order. If you don't have a design conception of social order, if you think that social order substantially is a matter of the spontaneous ordering of the components of that order in response to their perceptions of one another's behavior, then your notion of the law that is appropriate is precisely these rules of just conduct. They're the rules which, if people tend to abide by them, people will be able to coordinate successfully. So again, rules like don't take other people's possessions, rules like keep your contracts, it's people's confidence that such rules will be abided by that enables them to coordinate with one another to mutual advantage. And to the extent to which an order is governed by these types of rules, it's spontaneous and it doesn't need to be ordered by any political authority.
Now, let me ask you this question on spontaneous order. So you've kind of teased out for us, we have these broad rules, keep your contracts, don't take other people's property, respect their gains, don't try and unjustly appropriate them. So, but I want to ask you, would America be a spontaneous order for Hayek, given that we have we consciously articulated and designed a written constitution? Now, we could say it takes into account the history of the colonies and that there are separate colonies who had a separate political life of their own in many ways before the Union. There was also the Articles of Confederation. Maybe it's not quite such a design that he's discussing, and yet there is, just with respect to this commerce, there's clearly an intention to have a national commercial market, and the Constitution is written in that way. There's also a desire to leave a lot of things to the states. Of course, that's been flipped in many respects. But I guess I take it Hayek wouldn't just say that any old spontaneous order is good.
Right. So I think that's a really hard question for Hayek, because the question is, what standard does he have to evaluate spontaneous orders? And there are times in his most non-rationalist or anti-rationalist phases, moments, where he seems to say that there's no standard for evaluating any order except whether or not it has come into existence. And that's a real problem for Hayek. I think he should have the less anti-rationalist stance that we evaluate orders, spontaneous orders, by how well they embody these sorts of norms that make cooperation to mutual advantage successful. So conceivably, one could have an order that was in some sense spontaneous, unplanned, but truly vicious and nasty and didn't accord people the rights that they would have under rules of just conduct. It's hard for Hayek, insofar as he only has a did-this-emerge standard, to condemn or criticize such an order. It wouldn't be hard for him to condemn or criticize such an order if his focus was more on the vindication of these rules of just conduct, and he could say those rules are not operative in this particular type of spontaneous order, and so it's subject to criticism. Should I come back to the America is America?
If you want to address that. I've always wondered that myself, and so I wanted to pose that question to you.
Yeah. So there's two levels of that question, right? There's the, is America sort of ideally conceived a spontaneous order, right? Mm-hmm. Or is the actual world that we have a spontaneous order? So the second question, I guess, is less interesting. It's a question of, how far does America depart from what Hayek thinks it ought to be? So let's talk about the first question. So does a society which has an explicitly written constitution, does that itself violate the notion of the society being a spontaneous order? I think Hayek should say no. And we know that in the third volume of Law, Liberty, and Legislation, he himself makes constitutional recommendations, a new constitutional order. The complication is that Hayek tends, especially in his most non-rationalist moments, to say not only is the substance of the nitty-gritty of the economic order and social order, not only does that have to be unplanned, but the constitutional order that enables that nitty-gritty order to exist as a spontaneous order also has to be unplanned. So he wants to, I mean, he's real, when he's taken with this notion of the greater fruitfulness of spontaneous orders, he's tempted to say that not only how people interact on a given day in terms of what they buy and sell has to be spontaneous and unplanned, but even the order of rules and even the order of constitutional rules should be unplanned. And when he says that, he's taking a position which is inconsistent with the whole idea of a consciously designed constitution. This takes us to the issue of the constructive rationalism.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So let me pursue that a minute. So Hayek is really, really impressed by the extent to which good stuff arises without being intended. So good stuff on the level of desirable economic interaction between people, but also good stuff on the level of law itself, of language, of morality. He thinks all of these things are the product of evolution and accommodation of people to one another and to the sorts of circumstances that they find themselves in. And what we get out of that evolutionary process is something better than any group of cavemen sitting around thinking, hey, should we create language, would possibly have. And he's right that the sorts of abstract orders that make good social interaction possible, abstract orders like language, abstract orders like the existence of money, abstract orders like a body of rules of just conduct, these were not the product of human design. They did evolve. They came into existence because, as he would put it, societies that stumbled upon these orders were more likely to succeed than societies that didn't, more likely to expand, more likely to be imitated. So Hayek is completely right to think that reason can't be given the role of creating these abstract orders. We have to rely upon invisible hand processes for them to come about. Unfortunately, Hayek seems to often think that if reason can't be expected to create a certain order, reason can't even be expected to see the justification for the order, right? Or to take the order as it has evolved and then maybe tweak it in various ways on the basis of reason. And so Hayek will often say, well, we have these fundamental modes of conduct, these fundamental norms that have evolved over time. It's crazy to think that reason designed these norms, seeing what their good consequences would be. And he typically goes from that to say, well, therefore, we can't even hold these norms up to reason now and ask whether reason, in fact, favors the affirmation of these norms. Okay? So when he's criticizing constructivist rationalism, he means to start out by criticizing the idea that reason can create these norms, can discover these norms. But that typically flows over to the conclusion that reason shouldn't even be brought forward to test the norms. And that is amazingly ironic because his two main works in political philosophy, Constitution of Law and Law, Liberty, and Legislation, start out by saying, we need a new justification for these norms. And now I'm going to give you the new justification. And he does seem to give justifications for the norms, but then at crucial moments he goes, oh my God, that's a type of constructivist rationalism. I really can't do that. So he's of two minds, right? On the one hand, he thinks he can give a type of justification for these basic norms. We can say why it's a good thing to have language, because in fact it enables us to do all these things in terms of communication. But Hayek is continually afraid that as soon as you say, I know what the rational justification of a certain set of norms is, you will think, oh, well, these norms are subject to design. We can redesign them at will. We can bring in reason to wipe the slate clean and start all over again. He's so worried about that that he always backs away from the justificatory process.
Now, this, I mean, there's, I fast forward the discussion into the common law and really what is law and what is legislation,
yeah.
Particularly in this first volume. However, what you've just said leads me to ask you the question about freedom and expediency, yeah. I think, yeah. Which he discusses in Rules and Order and how freedom tends to lose out slowly to expediency because we really can't see what we've lost by not sticking to these rules of just conduct and the free abstract order they support. And this is, of course, resonant something that means a lot to us now after, I think, what's happened in the last 5 years, particularly in 2008, with the bailouts that we were told that expediency justified them. Right. And expediency also justifies all manner of the regulatory state and its interventions. So this is, I mean, this is something that has a lot of cachet with us now. But how does he defend freedom versus expediency, given what you've said, and the fear even to use reason to justify these norms, these laws?
Yeah. So, in the Constitution of Liberty, where the focus is directly on freedom, there his argument is that if we face a situation where we're considering some intrusion upon freedom for the sake of achieving some particular end, we'll always be biased towards the intrusion. And we'll always be biased for the intrusion because we're vividly perceiving at least what we think will be the good consequences of the intervention, whereas the bad consequences of the intervention will be things that people would have done in the exercise of their freedom if their freedom wasn't taken away, and we don't know what those will be, right? And so there's a general bias on behalf of intervention, which can only be blocked by some sort of enhanced status for freedom. So in these passages, Hayek says, we have to, even though freedom is important as a means to the end of prosperity or whatever, we have to perceive it as something like an end in itself in order to have the attachment to it that will block this bias, that will overcome this bias towards infringements upon freedom. I'm not sure how happy he is with that way of putting it. And one of the benefits of the switch to the rules of just conduct and the sort of Humean story is that then Hayek can say, as Hume does, these rules of just conduct work for us and enable people in an ongoing way to cooperate for mutual advantage, but only insofar as people are sure that these rules are going to be applied and that they'll be applied in the future. Right? So here it's we bring in the concern about how people's perceptions will change in the future if there are exceptions to the rules now. And it's in a particular case, we can easily envision how, according to some standard, things would be better if we break the rules. But part of the effect of that is not just what people lose on that occasion, but a major part of the effect is people lose the certainty of the enforcement of the rules, and that screws up future coordination. So I think that's and there, what we're defending is the strict compliance with the rules of just conduct. Freedom comes out of that as a byproduct, right? To be free is simply to live in a world where other people are reliably abiding by these rules.
So we might have to say, given Hayek's defense, we have to cultivate certain things like virtues of patience. Maybe even a certain piety towards the order you're in, a respect for the givenness of it.
Well, especially the latter two. And so that's another element of this humility that you spoke about, or ignorance. I mean, I think Hayek would say some of these problems of the tempting deviation from the rule or the tempting deviation from freedom are a product of our vastly overestimating our capacity to say what the particular results will be if we deviate. And on the other hand, there's this idea that what we should stick with is often something that we really don't understand very well. We just have a sense that there's something wrong with deviating from the existing pattern, but we should be prepared to go along with those prejudices or biases towards certain ways of acting or not acting.
What's interesting in this regard, I think, is maybe a dialectical relationship of the tremendous power and prosperity that this society produces that Hayek's defining. Say one manifestation might be Anglo-American common law and the capitalist system, but yet this actually, it might be the very power and prosperity that the system gives us that leads us to think we can go beyond it. Yeah. We can go beyond the rules that have produced it and actually perfect it, make it better, and then we can get into volume two, the mirage of social justice, right. Distribute the gains fairly and evenly, make people more happy, secure. And I know Hayek has a tremendous response to that. So law and legislation, we've talked about, I think, some distinguishing characteristics. Sketch that for us with respect to, I take Hayek in volume one as saying it's really all or nothing, that a system with significant features of the common law introducing this powerful understanding of legislation, that legislation over time will displace it. That it really, you really do have to have the spontaneous order needs that system of law, as Hayek defines it, which the historical manifestation is Anglo-American common law. Right. I think also seems important too, the role of the judge for Hayek is tremendous. And yet if the judge is intervening a lot, then the spontaneous order may not be working so well. So that's, the judge himself is limited, I think.
Right, right. So well, it's clearly Hayek's real picture of law and picture of the evolution of law, right, crucially involves the notion of judge-made or judge-found law. And I think one of the weaknesses, probably, of Hayek's position is that it presumes that a certain particular version of the rise of common law in England is the story about where law comes from, right? And this goes back to what I said earlier about that sometimes he needs to rely upon the idea that, well, something is good because it evolved. But then the question is, what has evolved? There has evolved the common law, but of course, radically different notions of law and systems of law elsewhere. Still, the crucial thing I think about judge-made law is that decisions that judges make, as Hayek sees it, are decisions about how to apply the rules that people had reason to expect would be applied in their circumstances. The role of the judge is not to do social justice. The role of the judge is not to solve social problems. The role of the judge is to enforce and perhaps modify over time understood norms that people rely upon in order to live with one another. Legislation for Hayek, right, tends to be the opposite. Legislation tends to be the sort of law that is appropriate for an organization, right? So the legislator in this negative sense, right, is somebody who has some policy in mind, maybe on the basis of some notion of social justice, maybe on the basis of something else, and he wants to impose that particular set of values on the society at large. This is going to involve, maybe in his mind, advancing the good of some people at the expense of other people. That's what legislation is fundamentally about. That is, when the legislator legislates for people at large and tells people at large how they ought to live their lives, What he is doing is acting as a commander, commanding society conceived of as an organization which the legislator has to arrange properly. So Hayek ultimately in Law, Liberty, and Legislation somewhat strangely says, well, there's a role for legislation, but the legislation that he's talking about, well, there are two types of legislation. The legislation, there's legislation which involves a particular assembly getting together and basically doing the job of a council of judges. Is there a problem with the particular rules that we are currently enforcing in terms of their ability to get people to live together in harmony? If there's a problem with some of these rules, we can tinker with them, and we can produce improvements in terms of norms that enable people to get together with one another. Insofar as you have a legislative body that does that, again, I say that legislative body is like a council of judges, and that's okay. Okay, and that sort of improvement in the rules of just conduct is completely consistent with the society as a whole remaining a spontaneous order. Right? Hayek's claim in the third book of Law, Liberty, and Legislation is that that type of lawmaking or law discovering should not be confused with something else that popular assemblies do, which is to give instructions to governmental employees about how they, as governmental employees, ought to behave. And when legislators do that, they are, of course, directing particular people, telling those people precisely what purposes they ought to serve and how they should go about serving those purposes. It's perfectly fine for government to instruct its employees about how they should behave, but in Law, Liberty, and Legislation, Hayek's idea is we can avoid confusing these two different types of law by having one legislative body work at refining the rules of just conduct and another legislative body whose job is solely to give instructions to members of the government about how they should enforce these rules of just conduct. So citizens at large are not administered by the government. The only people who are administered by the government are members of the government.
Okay. Now, this would be a good transition point maybe into Volume 2, The Mirage
yeah.
of Social Justice in talking about legislation. So how does social justice fail for Hayek? And I guess we should say, what is
yeah.
social justice according
yeah.
to Hayek?
Yeah. So Hayek has two different things in mind when he talks about social justice. Hayek sees that the dominant, the most salient claim of people he calls socialists shifts from a call for centrally planned economies to a call for downward economic redistribution. This is worrisome for Hayek. Hayek wants to be, he's obviously against central economic planning. He's also against significant downward economic redistribution. But he starts off his career arguing against central economic planning, and he's continually searching for some way that he can extend his argument against central economic planning so it also is an argument against downward redistribution, right? So one thing he means by social justice is a demand for systematic downward economic redistribution. He also means something much more specific than that. He means by social justice the demand that the government arrange things so that everybody has the level of income that he or she deserves. Okay. So he has also this very specific understanding of what social justice would be, and it's this idea of matching income to levels of merit or virtue. And one of the problems in Hayek is that he thinks that by giving arguments against this more specific understanding of social justice, the government should match income to levels of merit, that he's thereby managing to dismiss all calls for strong downward redistribution. So he's against downward redistribution. He's against distribution in accordance with merit. Most of his arguments against downward redistribution are really only arguments against redistribution according to merit. They're good arguments against redistribution according to merit, but they're not going to do the whole job. Okay, so let me just The good arguments against distribution according to merit, and you can see how Hayek would like these arguments, is, first of all, the government would have to know much more than it can possibly know, because it can't possibly know how meritorious people are. And in addition, this would require gigantic governmental bureaucracies and all this sort of stuff. Then furthermore, and I think this is the best argument, the neatest argument that Hayek has against distribution according to merit. Suppose we could find out how meritorious people were, and we did institute a system in which people were remunerated according to merit. That would be really, really bad, Hayek says. And the reason that it would be really bad is that we would now give people incentive to be meritorious. But we don't want people to be meritorious. We want people to produce the things that other people are willing to pay for. And that might have no connection with being meritorious. Especially for Hayek, he understands merit as being a matter of painful effort. Right? So to reward merit is to give people the incentive to engage in painful effort. We don't want people to engage in painful effort. If you can effortlessly produce something that's really valuable for other people, that's what we want you to have the incentive to do. So that, I think, is extremely clever, right? The role of remuneration has nothing to do in a sort of advanced market economy, nothing to do with matching what people do in terms of how meritorious it is with reward. The role of remuneration is to incentivize people to do what other people are willing to pay for and to signal people about what they might do in order to have a higher return. Very nice argument, I think. The problem for Hayek is that no modern defender of robust downward redistribution defends that position on this merit argument.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that.
Exactly. And so
it's more of an emancipating people
just the view that a certain pattern or profile of income is close to inherently just. So the extreme version of this might be that we can just see that equality of income is something that ought to exist. Not because people are equally meritorious, but just equality is the way income should be divided, right? Or the Rawlsian principle that income should be divided so that those who get the smallest, who are on the lowest rung of the income ladder, that rung is raised as high as possible, right? So one should have downward redistribution until any more redistribution would hurt the poor. But not on the basis of any notion of merit.
Yeah.
Hayek, for the most part, doesn't have any arguments against this position. Okay? I say for the most part because he has some more pragmatic arguments. He'll have arguments that say here's a slightly non-pragmatic argument. I think it's not a bad argument. He says somebody comes forward with some proposal about under the name of social justice.
Yeah.
Let's suppose it's not based upon this merit, so the merit critique of it doesn't apply. Somebody comes forward with this proposal. We see right away that to take up this proposal would require a vast increase in governmental power. Even if we like the proposal, we shouldn't infer from that that the state really has the authority to carry out the proposal. We would need an independent argument to show that the state has the authority to exercise the powers that would have to be exercised to carry this proposal out. So once again, we shouldn't infer, even if we like the proposal, that as soon as we see that it requires lots more in the way of political authority, we should say, well, it could very well be this is a great proposal, but it can't be carried out because political authority to do it doesn't exist. That, I think, is a nice argument. And then the more pragmatic argument is just the way the vocabulary of social justice becomes a slogan, an effective slogan, for every special interest that you can imagine.
Yeah.
And especially if you've already said, well, of course, government has the authority to act in the name of this slogan, social justice, then, of course, there is a bandwagon. People are jumping on the bandwagon. And since the notion is also so vague,
there's no limiting principle.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. I mean, anybody with a glib spokesman and a good lobbying effort can turn out to be the person that social justice now has to serve.
I want to ask you a couple of questions on the social justice part of Hayek. I mean, one is thinking social justice clearly has a hold on people. It seems to be tremendously important. A lot of people, if you ask them if you're for social justice, they think it means something like, this is in America in particular, I think it's, well, this is something like the common good. I mean, I think that's what they mean.
Yeah.
And who would be opposed to that? And of course, we do have so much stuff. Why shouldn't people have more? It becomes unconscionable the richer we become to actually look down and see people in some degree of want, although as we've, a lot of studies show, the poor in America are actually doing fine in a lot of material categories. So my question to you is, and thinking about Hayek's The Mirage of Social Justice, you've indicated you think it's really deficient, I think, for the most part in the argument. Yeah. So, and maybe this is a question just to you, is there some problem with free market capitalism and the idea of very limited government that it's never been able, it seems, to have the moral high ground, mm-hmm. or to receive the acclaim of, I would say, the masses, but of a majority of people, that it really has their support, as opposed to we acknowledge it as something that gives us a lot of things and stuff, but we also acknowledge we need to make sure it's distributed in an equitable manner. And that seems to be actually, particularly in Western Europe, that's the majority. That's the default position.
Yeah. Well, I think actually Hayek speaks to that a lot. Not in the sense of giving a knockdown counter-argument, but an analysis of the situation. So Hayek has this view that our hardwired dispositions are substantially the dispositions that we developed at earlier stages of social development. They're basically a lot of our...
The human race?
The human race, I'm sorry. So that most of our hardwired dispositions reflect our sort of small tribe past, where there was much more social solidarity. There were not these problems of things are too complicated for us to know pretty much what's going on in other people's lives. We hanker after that type of small society existence. And we are bothered by living in a much larger, more anonymous, more abstract social order. And we often want to somehow impose upon that order the type of solidarity that existed in these earlier orders, that we're still substantially hardwired. And there are passages where Hayek says people hate the abstract order and the abstract rules that I'm talking about. They find this just intolerable. And Hayek doesn't have a solution. Well, the solution is in a way a strangely almost Marxist solution on Hayek's part. I think Hayek thinks that as a particular type of social order exists, people evolve into the sort of beings that fit within that social order. So it's like, as long as we have socialism for a certain number of years, people will evolve into good socialist men. If we retain the great society, the abstract liberal order, for long enough, Hayek thinks that gradually people will accommodate to that, and they will lose some of these more tribal. But that's a highly speculative long term. The closest thing to a shorter term solution is to explain to people that it's natural for human beings to live in different worlds at the same time. So as a member of the great liberal social order, we live in a world where we're related to most other people in terms of only these very abstract arm's length principles. I won't take your stuff if you don't take mine. I'll keep my contracts if you keep yours. But we're not going to be worried about the substance of one another's desires or interests, and we're not going to be, for the most part, involved in positively promoting other people's ends. We can live in that world, but we can also, Hayek says, live in small society worlds, in family, right, or in whatever, church groups, or all sorts of voluntary organizations within society are possible. What we have to learn, I think Hayek says, is that those are the place for some of our hardwired dispositions, and we shouldn't think that those hardwired dispositions can be carried over to or embedded into the larger social order. If we do that, we're going to destroy the larger, abstract, prosperity-generating social order.
Interesting, his naturalistic account, where that would leave freedom, what other being would think abstractly and come up with these conceptions to begin with and want to privilege them and protect them and yet recognize some sort of individuation process that also leaves us at war with them? That in itself seems curious to me. I mean, it seems to be that freedom does, in certain respects, depend upon accepting man out of a purely naturalistic account.
So I think you're right. I think there's this... there's a strong, in a way, Kantian element in Hayek, and the way it comes out here is that what's higher in human life is what's more abstract, and that in terms of our particular desires and our particular impulses, these are always irrational for Hayek. They're a matter of instinct, or they're a matter of desire, some other somewhat sort of denigrated term that this is the realm of the will. Okay. But these abstract rules that we have somehow to some extent learned to live in accordance with, although he wants to emphasize that they're evolved and not the product of reason, in other places he'll say this is the rational part of our nature. This is where reason, so it's sort of will and instinct, that's operative in the sort of small world. But insofar as we become rational beings, and in some sense, therefore, escape from the determination of the natural, we live in this more cosmopolitan, open world where we're not primarily driven by particular impulses and particular instincts.
Okay. Now, we should move forward here, and I just want to get briefly from you, what volume three, The Political Order of a Free People, not as frequently read, but yet an important way to tie together, I think, law and legislation.
Good.
Discuss that for us.
Well, first of all, there's the irony that has to be mentioned, right? That that Hayek includes among the sins of constructive rationalism thinking that one can sit down at one's desk and write out what the social order for a society ought to be. He thinks that, but the third volume is devoted to not just how to sort of modify slightly the existing constitution, but what a better constitutional order would be.
Just like Thomas Paine.
Just like Thomas Paine.
Okay. Exactly. He's got it in his pocket.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. And then also in the Constitution of Liberty, he says that the U.S. Constitution has been a great success. And then this is when the first volume is issued of Law, Liberty, and Legislation, 13 years later, a little bit more for the third volume, there he says the U.S. Constitution has failed. And we have got to learn from that failure. And the main device, which I mentioned before, not as clearly as I should have, is he thinks the problem has been that that there's been a resurgence of what is essentially a really primitive idea that the social order has to be an organized order. And along with the idea that the social order as a whole has to be a designed or organized order is the idea that law, in particular legislation, has to be a series of directives to people that tell people how to live their economic lives, their marital lives, their family lives. And insofar as legislation of that sort dominates, we undo the spontaneous order. We convert society into an organization, and that's bad for all sorts of reasons. The institutional suggestion that Hayek has is, well, we want to make clear to people that the basic law are these rules about how private individuals deal with one another. The true law is the private law. The law of contract and torts and property, that's the true law, right? We may have to modify it somewhat over time, but that's the sort of, if we have a legislative body, an assembly that is devoted to the true law, which is the private law, what they will do is just, you know, some issue about whether or not a particular type of entity ought to be subject to a copyright, to a patent. They will deal with those sorts of things. But they will deal with it not as a matter of making social policy, but as a matter of extending the basic norms that we have within the private law. So we should have one representative assembly that deals with that. And they are telling everybody in society how they ought to interact with everybody else. And they're basically clarifying the terms on the basis of which a spontaneous order will exist. Among the things that exist within spontaneous order is this one particular organization called the government. And the government's role primarily is to articulate and enforce these rules of just conduct. But it has to do that in particular ways, by perhaps having a police force, by setting up courts, by whatever sort of other mechanisms of that sort. And those mechanisms are designed orders, and the people who occupy positions in those mechanisms have to be given directives about how they should function. And so there ought to be another assembly, another representative assembly, that is concerned with that. That representative assembly gives directives to an organization, but the organization is not society at large, it's the government. And the directives apply to the members of the government. And so we do have this organizational structure, but we're not as tempted to think that since good law is a set of nice, clear directives, we should come up with the nice, clear directives which will tell everybody in society how they should behave. So we emphasize again the sort of, very important classical liberal notion that It's crucial to distinguish between society and the norms that govern the members of the society vis-a-vis one another, and government, which is just a very special institution which has a particular function and has to have somebody direct the members of that institution.
Professor Mack, I think we can end there.
Good. So thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Good.
This is your host, Richard Reinsch, and you have been listening to a podcast that can be found at libertylawtalk.org, where you can subscribe, comment, find other episodes and links relevant to today's conversation. Our email address is mail@libertylawtalk.org.